Good evening. Welcome to River Styx at Duff's. Let me invite anybody sitting in the bar room to move in here so the poets can see the audience, and we have some room in here. Tonight, this is a great reading, and we have a select crowd here for it, and I think you will be happy you're here. Two wonderful poets, each of which are special people, and people I'm very happy to call personal friends, Carter Rivard and Jerome Rothenberg. We're going to start with Carter Rivard and close with Jerry Rothenberg. Carter Rivard is one of America's most highly regarded Native American poets. He was born in the Osage Indian Agency town of Pawhuska, Oklahoma in 1931, one of seven mixed-blood children. He completed his first eight grades in a one-room county country school where he worked, and during that time he worked as the school janitor, as a farmhand, as a greyhound trainer throughout his high school. Doing that through his high school years. He got to college through an intricate series of events, but by ultimately winning a radio quiz scholarship to the universe, a quiz program scholarship that landed him at the University of Tulsa. And subsequently, upon graduation, was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship, which took him to Oxford, England, and he went on to earn a PhD at Yale and enjoy a long teaching career at Washington University, from which he retired in 1998. One of the high points in his life occurred in 1952, when he was given his Osage name by his grandmother, Mrs. Josephine Jump, and the tribal elders. Since the late 60s, he's been publishing a lot of poetry and essays, and is published in virtually all of the Native American literary anthologies, as well as in several of his own books. Among the titles, Cowboys and Indians, Christmas Shopping, and Ponca War Dancers, and An Eagle Nation, published in 1993 from the University of Arizona Press. His most recent book is the memoir, Family Matters, Tribal Affairs, which was also published by University of Arizona Press, this time in 1998. To describe his work is difficult, but I would say it has a curious combination of both erudite and folksy. He's a unique voice who's conversant with both Western and Native American literary, historic, and mythic traditions. He's also a great raconteur, encyclopedic mind, an absent-minded professor, and someone who's a delight to be around. So please welcome Carter Rivard.
I'm very happy to be here. I'm particularly happy to be here with Jerome Rothenberg, who's done some tremendous things. And I forgot to bring my copy of Shaking the Pumpkin. I'll have to have you sign it before you go back to. But anyway, I'm very happy. But I'm also happy because I go back way a long time with the River Styx. Michael Castro was a student in my Chaucer class about 68-9. We went through some of the trying times, which you may have been reading about in the Riverfront Times and the Post-Dispatch lately. Though I hope you will be very careful in thinking how those things were then compared with some of the descriptions of them that you get now. But the reporters here are pretty good. I haven't seen what the Arizona people did yet about Howard Mechanic, but they did read me the story from the Arizona Republic over the phone, the woman who'd come and done that interview, and so I think that probably is going to be clear enough. I'm going to try doing some little different things here. You guys have heard some of my stuff before. And rather than bore you by repeating all of it or some of it that you've heard before, I'm going to try doing a little different thing. I'm going to try doing a translation or two. I work with medieval stuff as well, and I've been working with a particular manuscript for a long time, and in it there are four what are called fablios. Now, I'm not sure that whether before I retired I would have dared to read this, because the reputation of Washington University is bad enough as it is. And it nearly got ruined by my being misquoted about grammar, and I managed to correct that in a letter, and I hope you will believe that the grammar at Washington University is not suffering too much from my presence during the time I did. I'm going to read then a fablio. Fablio is French for dirty story, but it's a funny dirty story. I guess all dirty stories are funny, aren't they? Unless you're involved in them, in which case they're tragic. The French farce is always about adultery, and that's great fun as long as you're not one of the principals. A lot of these things involve some things that you'd never do outside a fablio, I suppose. Very unrealistic. This one is called The Knight of the Basket, and it occurs in only the one manuscript, which happened to be the one that I've worked with a lot, written, copied by a man around Ludlow who was involved in all kinds of things. The takeover of England in 1326 by Roger Mortimer and the Queen, who was his lover, the death of Edward II, as you know, by a hot poker put into a very intimate part of his anatomy. And I've been told by people not present but who've read the Chronicles directly that there was considerable noise made when that happened. I think in the play Edward II, he's by Marlowe, it's presented as mainly killing him by strangling on a table, but I think they had the hot poker in there too. Anyway, this scribe was involved in this, so it wouldn't be surprising if he had a few fablios like this. This is a curious combination of a very courtly set of assumptions about human love affairs and a very earthy and uncourtly set of assumptions. I'm just going to read it. I've turned it from French into tetrameter couplets, and you can see, I think it's fairly close most of the time. There is some uncertainty because he has to get up to the top of the wall, and he's not Santa Claus, and he doesn't have reindeer, so what he gets is a basket. And in the French, it's not too clear just how that basket thing is arranged. So I have got a winch and a kind of a balance beam business in here, which I think is okay, but it's not that absolutely certain. So I think other than that, it's pretty close. And you Chevalier à la Corbeille. Because a lot of you have asked it, the story of the knight and basket I'll tell you, if you'd like to hear it. A knight renowned for heart and spirit fell for a much-respected dame, who burnt for him with equal flame. Though love at distance they found sweet, they looked for ways to closer meet. But they could never get together. Her husband kept her on a tether. Just a few words could they confide, so strictly was she kept inside. But stony limits cannot keep love out, as someone said, and this was not about to foil a woman's ingenuity, which passes masculine acuity. The knight had asked her, "Will you have me?" And she'd replied, "I will, and gladly, but only when we fix things right. Damsel and maid must be kept quiet, and in their rooms, because my spouse has eyes and ears throughout the house." It takes a lot to fool a knave, unless you know how to behave more knavishly, you're down the drain. No other way might one attain access to such a chatelaine, unless by even greater pain such walls and ditches her enclose, and even should one get past those, and somehow passing every danger, get right into the lady's chamber, the bedroom where she lies at ease, yet to enjoy her as you please were no light task, I'm telling you. The hardest part is still to do, for always in that room there lies a crone who heads the husband's spies, a battle-axe who, if her dame gets out of sight, goes crying shame to the castle's lord, her son, indeed, and he believes her like the creed. This jealous spouse of whom I speak went to a tournament one week, as barons should, who've lots of gold. The amorous knight, out in the cold, still hoped that he could some way find to manage what he had in mind. "Just now the lord's preoccupied. It's time for me to slip inside and try to see my love," he said. He knew the porter was well-bred, and by him sent word up to greet his lady, who returned a most discreet reply. "Friend, bring him up this minute. I've something needs his counsel in it that's underway in the castle here." Entrance he's given, free and clear. Those other knights he meets within greet him with joy that he's come in. His love receives him like a flower, but that old crone looks mean and sour. Suspecting rightly what he's doing, she frowns and wonders what is brewing. Upon a rug they sit them down, and there beneath the old crone's frown, their parliament of love debates a closer union of their states, although they have but little time. "Lady," he said, "'twould be no crime if it pleased God that serious harm should strike that witch in leg or arm, and cripple her, or hunchback make, for of her tongue she's just a snake. Never, for Jesus Christ's sweet sake, will truth instead of lies come from her, to have her guarding you's a bummer. My lord, that creature's sociopathic. The fate I'd wish on her is graphic, to die in rage at what she spied. Her heart is evil, petrified. If doctors had a deafness pill, I'd put one in her breakfast swill. Little she sleeps, is wakeful still, has ears much sharper than a mouse's, and all she hears is soon my spouse's. Some people say old folks can't hear. That's hardly true of her, I fear. She'd hear a love sigh far or near. Well, we may hope, my lady bright, that she'll be racked by gout all night. Such punishment would fit her sweetly. But, dear God, lady, won't you treat me as I deserve? I've loved so long, you know I have, and you're so wrong to make me suffer as you do. Suffer, said she. But I love you, my handsome knight, so much I would become your lover if I could. Look at these bars and that wall. Can you see any way at all? I wish I might escape and be with you in Spain or Lombardy. Lady, I'll not prove cowardly. As God this body shall set free, I vow that I will make my way into this castle, and I say that we will take such great delight as only lovers find by night. Come soon, sweet love, soon as you can. Oh, come to-night, my handsome man. I'll hide you so that no soul may observe your coming, and you'll stay in my embrace and I in yours, and we'll enjoy such close amours that there shall never after this come anything to spoil our bliss. Amen, said he, seal with a kiss. I'll come this night, I will not fail. Splendid, said she, may you prevail. With that they stopped their sotto voce, rise and exchange their buonanotte. Nearby the old crone listened well, but caught no words that she could tell. The lady drank a final toast, the knight at last congéd the host. His lady, too, then made a deft examination as he left of how her room was situated. The walls were sheer, some crenellated. From one an eave sloped out, and there he saw an open window where from chamber pots the servants throw their filth among the cows below, or dump spoilt veggies to the cows. Through that he could fulfill his vows. So off he goes to find his squire, with him discreetly to conspire, that he'd come help in this dark hour. A woodshed was beneath her bower, right at the ball's foot. There they'd cower till night, when folks had gone to bed. The nimble squire would scale the wall and lurk until his master's call. The squire's not happy with that role, but things are out of his control. So like a good and loyal man, the squire accepts his master's plan. He doesn't dare do otherwise. First, they must fool the watchman's eyes. Towards the shed the knight tiptoes, and down among its firewood goes, using rush bundles for a screen, hides till the guard has quit the scene. Then, waiting till they're all at rest, the knight continues on his quest. Although the task is well begun, far more this knight must yet be done. Here ready, by the wall, he's found a king-size basket strongly bound for winching up firewood and drink. He hardly needs to stop and think. Just curls up in that basket snug, loosens his hitch, and gives a tug. At once right up the wall, it's yanked, then quickly along the high wall cranked to stop at the kitchen window's ledge. He's earned his sweet, fulfilled his pledge. All sleepless lies the lady bright. Her mind is wholly on the night. She listens for the slightest stir that might announce he's come to her. Towards her boudoir tiptoes he, where she is waiting breathlessly. Sweetest reward she promises, a joy that's no less hers than his. Silent into her love-nest led, he sinks with her upon the bed to deeper joys than can be said. Close by the old crone lies in wait, her heart on fire with jealous hate, sleepless and watchful on her bed. Their beds both share a single spread, a king-size satiny duvet, reaching from where the old crone lay to cover up that couple's play. But when the knight has climbed aboard to do his business like a lord, this duvet starts in jumping so the crone pipes up. "I'd like to know what's going on with your duvet that it goes back and forth this way." "Madame, these fleas are biting so. My scratching makes this duvet go such crazy ways, if you must know." This answer has the ring of truth, or so the crone thinks. Then the youth begins to make that duvet crawl. However well a king may bawl, it's nothing next to what the knight and dame get up to on this night. So valiantly these lovers tourney, that up and down the covers journey. Over the crone they jiggle too, and she, who knows a thing or two of clever tricks and treachery, thinks scratching flea bites may not be what makes this duvet leap and dance. She slips from bed at her first chance and goes to light some candle ends at the kitchen's coals, or so intends. Passing the window, though, she stumbles and plump into the basket tumbles, thus giving to its rope a jerk. The men below get right to work to winch the basket down again, not knowing what it does contain, that wretched old mother-in-law. A brilliant, star-filled sky she saw as down she came. But when the man saw it was she, he turned and ran, escaping any way he can, which meant she had a little brief period to realize what grief she'd got into beyond belief. The balance beam at first went down and swung her up, then she went down as it went up, suspended there as if on tenterhooks of air. Never had she been so tormented. She wondered if she was demented, or whether some malicious fairy had enchanted her, or demons carried her down to hell, until at last the basket to the flagstones crashed, and she was thrown out on her rear. When she got up, the world seemed queer. I needn't lay out all the hassle by which she got back in the castle, and dragged herself back into bed, a tremble like a leaf for dread, when freezing north wind snatches it, and hardly could she talk a bit, but to the lady she did say, "A wildfire burned that damned duvet. It got me in some mess, all right. Never was I in such a plight, abused by fiends who walk at night." Of course the lovers took delight in hearing what had happened to her. So did the squire, you may be sure. The knight thereafter took his pleasure each night the lady was at leisure. The crone no longer hung around to spy on them, or even frowned. Once was enough to hit the ground. Nor did she care to listen for that duvet slipping to the floor, or who went in or out the door. It's only right, if you harm people, that you should suffer in the sequel. And now I've told you, since you asked it, of that old crone and of the basket. So that's the Fabliau. It's a terribly interesting manuscript, and has several lives of saints, St. Ethelbert of Hereford and Ettfrid of Leominster, and Whiston of Whistonstow, for whom W.H. Auden was named, I guess. So it has some other things than Fabliaux. And one of the problems has been always to figure out why the Fabliaux are in there. And if you want to read about that, you can look at the next issue of Medium Maivum, where I've written the definitive explanation until some other scholar comes along and shows how wrong I am. Now, since I'm doing a translation there, I thought I would read another one, which I've read before in here, of an Old English riddle. And I've talked before here, I hope can talk very briefly now, about a riddle. I'm interested in it partly because at Oxford I had to study the Anglo-Saxon, and that included some of the riddles. And one of my good friends over there, Bruce Mitchell, was doing his doctorate at the time we were in the rowing crew for the Merton College third aid. That was what they called the school's aid. Sometimes in a school, schools is the final exams. And during that 8 week, the colleges put their very best people into their first boat, and they are, you know, really the equivalent of a Harvard or a Yale or a whatever the best people around the world are. And we at that point were head of the river, Merton College, and we had an excellent first aid. They got bumped by Magdalen College first aid, but after the races were over and we had our bump supper, we went out into the streets after the bump supper, and some of the people climbed over the wall into Magdalen College, whose aid had bumped us, and they found the vice president of Magdalen, who told them they should leave, and they held him over the fish pond until he agreed that it was a fluke for Magdalen College to bump our boat. So we did have a good first aid, but I was in the third aid because I was getting ready to take schools, and that's the school's aid. You do all this to distract you and to give you such misery and grief that you forget about the misery and grief you're ready to go through in the schools. So Bruce was in that school's aid with me at that time. He later became the editor and the scholar who has written the definitive grammar of Old English. At that time, he was working on a dissertation, which was subjunctive clauses in Old English. Anyway, Bruce has edited some of these riddles and things, and I got a chance to talk to him. He's had a heart bypass lately. And he didn't disapprove this riddle that I this translation of a riddle that I did on the Swan. So I'm claiming that it's acceptable to a grammarian at Oxford. This is called the Swan's Song. It's in the it's one of the riddles in the Exeter Book, which is down in Exeter Cathedral Library in the south of England. If you go there, when we were there in 1966 at least, it was open to a page or folio with a great beer stain, round beer stain on the page. So the monks apparently enjoyed reading and drinking at the same time. What page it's open to now, or whether you can see it, I don't know. But if you go to Exeter Cathedral, See if you can have a look. It's a wonderful, huge book of Anglo-Saxon things. The Swan's Song, a riddle was, you didn't get the answer to it. It doesn't tell you in the extra book, this is the song of a swan. You have to guess. You have to deduce. You have to play Sherlock. It's a wonderful way of showing you how mysterious the world is, because in many cases, a riddle could be one of several terribly, terribly different things. For instance, since I started with the Fabliau, let me mention that one of the riddles involves a description of a thing, and of course in the riddle the thing itself talks. It's a dramatic monologue by this mysterious creature, thing, or whatever. This thing says, some things about a woman patted me and kneaded me and I rose. And then the dirty minds of all the readers, of course, are rebuked by the fact that this is bread dough. Okay. And I've not told you what you thought it was, but you know, and you probably are blushing because you were thinking this terrible thing, which the Anglo-Saxon riddle maker would never, of course, have done. On the other hand, the word for lady in Old English, hlafdia, loaf kneader, the kneader of loaves, and the word for lord, loaf guardian, hlafweard, okay, you've got those words which would have reinforced this riddle in a curious way, but the sexual double entendre is there in it. Not many of them are like that. I'm just saying that the riddles don't have to be sublime and so on, as this one is. This one is spoken by a being, and I've called it the Swan Song, so you know what it is. But if you listen, you'll find that it's about something other than the swan, just as the the October twilight mirrors a steel sky upon the brimming water among the swans, or 29 swans, I think it's 29. The part about the swan as taking off, going up into the heavens and so on, Yeats makes a great deal of that. The bell beat of their wings above my head. That's an accurate description, and it's part of what's going on in this poem. In the eight, in the crew, as we drew along the Thames there were certain parts where the swans had nests along the shore, and they would come out and dispute the right-of-way with the rowing crew. I was in the bow, so I got the brunt of some of these demonstrations by these unruly swans. Now, they all belong to the queen, and so you mustn't touch them. But that doesn't say you can't raise your oar and suggest that they get the hell out of there, or the queen will be sorry, something like that. Anyway, they did. They were very nice about it once you had an oar speak to them with. As they would take off, and as they would fly, their wings make a wonderful silken shrieking sound. And as they get up over your head, the bell beat of their wings above your head, as Yeats describes it, is what you do here. So when you hear in here the description of the robes and the wonderful music they make, you may think of not just swans, of course, but the angelic movement, which you get here. Swans are very silent, mute, a lot of them, okay? So that on the water and around, even up if they get up in the barnyard or wherever, they don't make any noise. They're silent. They are like monks, you could say. But when they do take off, then the music comes. Garbed in silence, I go on earth, dwell among men or move on the waters. Yet far over halls of heroes in time, my robes and the high air may raise and bear me up in heaven's power over all nations. My ornaments then are singing glories, and I go in song bright as a star, unstaying above the world's wide waters as a wayfaring soul. The final words of the poem in the Old English, fare and guest. Wayfaring is what far on to fare, farewell, and so on, comes, on over to. And guest is soul, ghost. Our word ghost comes out of the Anglo-Saxon word for spirit. So fare and guest, as it ends the poem, which is a wonderful final phrase there, suddenly makes that swan into all these other beautiful things. That's a translation of an Anglo-Saxon thing, and if you look in the Norton Anthology of Poetry or others where that occurs, you will find that my translation is better. At least so Bruce. Bruce hasn't told me that, but I think he will if I press him on it. I want to read one other riddle, which is not an old riddle, because when I was doing these in my History of the Language class, I had the students write riddles. I'll read two if I can find the very short two-line one. This would give you a sense of how the form of the riddle works, alliterative half-line, like that. And this one is one I wrote so that the students could see the pattern in two lines. And if I can find this, it's about a skunk, and I may have read it here before. As I say, they didn't have to be solemn and sacred, and I needed a short, easily memorized example against which the students could test lines they had composed to see if they fitted the patterns of alliteration and syllable counts, but stress counts and so on. Once when I was a boy, there was a skunk getting our chickens. My Uncle Bert had shot the skunk that night, and my grandfather said, "There's no use wasting that thing. Skunks are good to eat." And they are. You have to be mighty careful skinning them. Because if you get that gland wrong, then you can't eat it. At least not unless you're a hoot owl, a horned owl. Horned owls do catch skunks, and they smell for months. But either they don't have noses to smell that, or they think it's... Adder of roses. But anyway, Uncle Bert shot the skunk, and my grandfather said, "Don't waste it." And so, at the cost of some unpleasant skinning operations, and then some Colonel Sanders deep frying, we had a wonderful meal. Fried skunk is less gamey than rabbit or squirrel, tender as young chicken. Skunks don't have to run much, so their meat doesn't get tough. This is called De Gustibus. The old thing from Horace, is it, Peter? Yeah. There's no disputing about taste, which, of course, is totally untrue. There's nothing but disputing about taste. But anyway, to skin a skunk, skill is needed. But even fried, few will eat it. So that's a riddle. Now, I want to read the one more, which is... An Indian riddle. I was president of the board of the Indian Center downtown for some time. When I got elected president, there had been a whole lot of faction and friction and this and that and the other. So some of the traditional people decided that I needed all the help I could get, which was true. And Comanche lady, who was our executive director, and her husband had a whole lot of eagle feathers that they'd collected over years and years and years. They had to be registered or else they could be fined a whole lot with the government. So they had a whole trunkful of eagle feathers there. They gave me 9 tail feathers from the golden eagle, each of them, and a friend with whom I was one of the gourd dancers as we danced with these things, beaded that into a very beautiful fan. And so I made a poem for Dale and Bob and Evelyn as a in return for the gift they had given me. These are very important. The feathers are not dead, they're alive. They carry on the life. And the eagle carries the messages for us. So as you have that fan in the dance arena and so on, you're sending the prayers up. They can be used for blessings, they can be used for smudges, for, you know, for cedarings, for, they can be used when you see a dancer come into the dance ground, the head dancer. Usually he'll have the feathers on his head, and if you see him nodding this way and that, it's not, as the Europeans thought, just to be ornamental or to brag or to show off. There's a passage in Spenser that describes this as fancy and, if you know, fantasy and so on, as if it was the European decoration and so on. But it was no more merely decorative than the wonderful palaces in Italy with their paintings, or than the Sistine Chapel thing is. It's a part of a very spiritual, hate to use that word, but it's there, of a very spiritual sense of the beings of the world. So the eagle is terribly important. The feathers are a part of the ceremonial way of expressing thanks and doing prayers without words. Right? So I did the prayer poem for them as a riddle, as an old English riddle, in which the fan spoke and told where it came from, how it came to be there, what it does, and how it works with the human creatures. When you bead, you take, of course, a needle and sew those beautiful beads around and around on a white buckskin-wrapped wooden handle for the fan that you have set and glued the feathers into. So I'm, in this poem, comparing the eagle circling in the blue sky with the white clouds to the needle going round and round the buckskin handle and beading the patterns of red and blue. And I'm comparing that, of course, to the dance where you go round and round. Well, in this case, we go this way, counterclockwise, the way the sun goes. I'm comparing the eagle circling, the needle circling, and the dancers circling. And I'm talking about the gourd dance colors of scarlet and midnight blue, because the gourd dancer's sash has one half scarlet and one half dark blue, midnight blue. It's the day and night part. If you're dancing in the day, you have the scarlet over here. If you're dancing at night, you reverse and have the blue over here. So for the gourd dancers, and Dale is one of those who beaded it for me, and Bob and Evelyn, the Comanche and Kiowa are the people for whom the gourd dance comes. They taught me here in St. Louis. So when I became a gourd dancer, that was how I was taught. So the eagle fan speaks, and this is offering thanks for the honor of being given eagle feathers, which were then set into a beaded fan. The eagle pierces the clouds, and the riddle has to give mysterious names to things. The swan's feathers are referred to as my robes, or my ornaments, or my, all right. And so anyway, there are ways in which the riddle reminds you that you have to think hard to make things seem ordinary. And that if you think hard in this poem, you will see why they are extraordinary, why they are supernatural. Of course they're natural, but they are transnatural, supernatural, whatever. Okay. All right, the eagle fan is speaking. I strung dazzling thrones of thunder beings on a spiraling thread of spinning flight, beading dawn's blood and blue of noon to the gold and dark of day's leaving, circling with sun the soaring heaven over turquoise eyes of earth below,
her silver veins, her sable fur. Heard human relatives hunting beneath, calling me down, crying their need that I bring them closer to Wakanda's ways. And I turned from heaven to help them then. When the bullet came, it caught my heart. The hunter's hands gave earth its blood, loosened light beings, and let us float toward the sacred center of song in the drum, but fixed us first, firm in tree heart, that green light dancers gave to men's knives. Ash heart in hiding, where a deer's heart had beat, and a one-eyed serpent with silver straight head strung tiny rattles around white softness in beaded harmonies of blue and red. Now I move lightly in a man's left hand. Above dancing feet follow the sun around old songs, soaring toward heaven on human breath. And I help them rise. I'm going to read. Let's see. We need to get me through here fairly shortly. Mike, what do we got? What's what? One more? Yeah. Okay. A short. I'll do a riddle. I now call this Trinity. Trinity riddle. And it's in here. This is not a translation. It's like the other one. It's a one I made up. In the original, sometimes in the old English riddles, the poet would sign his name. Because as they're written down now, the Roman alphabet adapted to old English is used to write them. But before the Anglo-Saxons got hold of the Latin alphabet, around 400 and something, they had the runes from the Germanic people, and that is derived ultimately from the alphabet that the Greeks and Romans had too, but with a lot of other characters in it as well. So there are connections. When I say it's derived, it's related, I should say, closely. But the point about this is, in the Anglo-Saxon riddles, sometimes the poet, Akenna Wolf or somebody, would put runic characters instead of Latin alphabetic characters here and there. And if you put those runes together, you would find that the poet had signed his name in them. So that there was a way of identifying who wrote this poem sometimes in them. It would be possible also to put the name of the being speaking into those forms. What I've done in here is to use boldface, and I've used anagrams of the three forms of this being that I'm writing and reading about, so that if you read on the page, you would see the boldface with N-O-W-S and with E-C-I and with R-E-T-A-W. I had a hell of a time finding a way to get that last one in there in the right form. But anyway, that's the three forms. So I call this Trinity. Although descending, I bear a Samite of stars. Do you know what a Samite is? A Samite is that wonderful... I learned it from Tennyson in the poem... The Passing of Arthur, and so on. That wonderful hand comes up out of the lake and grabs the sword that I think it's Bedivere throws out there, and it's clothed in samite, which is a white, satin-like, very rich cloth. All right. So the first line says, although descending, I bear a samite of stars. All right. So you've got coming down like that. That wonderful Samite of stars. White fingers bring me for breakfast Mont Blanc, and I develop on Earth's negative the prince, proving a present absence. Or rainbow dancing, my restless soft self teaches the sun at his summer turn to reprise in dawn prisms the light praise of plants, to star in winter the still song homes with brittle jewels dropped bright from darkness. Or I shift my shape to shimmering self-traps. Now speak, if you spy it, the special name I bear in spring, when I bear tawdry alleys to wear till dawn night diamonds, till dusk the jewel of time. It's about as obscure, I hope, as any poem you will run into soon. But I thought, I even put footnotes down here. White fingers are glaciers up on Mont Blanc. They're bringing it down. Okay, those wonderful things there. You come down from heaven like a samite of stars. But on Mont Blanc, you become those fingers, which are bringing us for breakfast Mont Blanc. And I'm hoping you think of a baked Alaska there. And I develop on Earth's negative the prince, proving a present absence. And I suppose if you step in snow, you are known to be there, even though you're not. Right? So that's the prince there. And I hope the play with the photographs would be almost as complicated as some of the old English riddles. Rainbow dancing, my restless soft self teaches the sun at his summer turn to reprise in dawn prison the light rays of plants. I would suppose, you know what reprise is. At the end of a musical, you have these songs that, you know, repeat. And I'm teaching the sun, if this soft self version of my being, as dew, of course, to reprise the rainbows it ain't any longer a mystery, and probably ain't any, it wasn't ever a poem, but if you read it on the page, maybe you have to be there. Anyway, I had a lot of fun writing that, and I'm not going to go on and on at this point, because we're going to want to hear Jerry at this point. I'm going to stop here. I'm not going to read Indian poems and other poems to you. So I've got to get out of here and let some better things take place. Thanks very much.